This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a movie review from Matt Olien. But we are going to start today with a collaborative effort to change the way that grants are made and awarded within the Bush Foundation. They are indigenizing the grant process. Four area nonprofits were recently awarded a community-based grant partnership. And as we learn now from Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, this partnership focuses on Native American communities, highlighting their culture and traditions.
Today, I'm joined by the Good Relatives Collaborative, four nonprofits in a three-state region that are helping change the way grants are designed and aligned with the Bush Foundation objectives, with their focus primarily on Native American communities. The Bush Foundation describes this collaboration as they share a vision centered on community support and healing and on encouraging collaboration rather than competition. They're planning to work as partners and helpers, working with applicants on needs beyond only providing grants. I want to extend a warm welcome to Dr. Barb Schmidt of Black Hills Community Loan Fund in South Dakota, Lakota Vogel of the Four Bands Community Fund in South Dakota, Pamela Standing of the Minnesota Indigenous Business Alliance, and to Dr. Cheryl Carey of the Sacred Pipe Resource Center in Bismarck, North Dakota. What an opportunity to have all of you join us today. Thank you so much.
This is the first time the four of us have been in a room together. We were just doing a retreat this week since we found out that we received the partnership.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a celebration and a retreat, right?
Yeah.
So all
yep.
of us coming together, putting our minds together, and just really being in a space of saying, wow, we did it, we're here, and designing, you know, what looks right for our communities.
And it's definitely a time to celebrate. Congratulations on this huge accomplishment.
Thank you.
As I introduced each of you can go around the room and maybe sum up your nonprofit work. We'll start with you, Lakota.
Yeah. So as mentioned, I'm Lakota Vogel. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit located on the Cheyenne River Sioux Indian Reservation called Four Bands Community Fund, which it also has a CDFI, meaning a Community Development Financial Institution. So we really just look at ensuring our communities and natives across the state of South Dakota have access to capital, which can look like business loans, getting a better credit history. You can get a mortgage loan. So it's really about any question you have about finance, we're the go-to place across the state for Native Americans.
And I'm Barbara Schmidt. I'm the interim executive director at the Black Hills Community Loan Fund, and I'm fairly new. I'm only 2 months into the position, so I'm the newbie with this coalition. Our service area is actually the Rapid City proper, along with the four other counties that surround Rapid City. And like Lakota, we are a Native CDFI, and we provide products and services by credit building loans. We do home loans as well, rent assistance, and as well as entrepreneurship training, as well as literacy, financial literacy. If they have a low credit score, we can help them achieve a better credit score. So we do credit building as well as part of our services.
And I'm Pamela Standing. I'm the co-executive director of programs and partnerships for the Minnesota Indigenous Business Alliance. We serve the 11 tribal communities throughout Minnesota, and we also work with the urban populations as well. And we bring communities together to have conversations around how can we diversify our economies, how can we make our economies stronger, how can we help build more sustainable private business, small Native-owned businesses, and we also work with the artist community throughout the state of Minnesota.
I am Cheryl Carey. I'm with the Sacred Pipe Resource Center. We serve the Bismarck, Mandan, Lincoln population, primarily Native American population. I guess our cornerstone is community engagement. How do we get our Native community engaged in this community, participating in, you know, the social fabric, the social and civic fabric of our communities? Although we serve an urban population, we're always cognizant of our relationship with the tribal homelands that all of our population comes from.
Beautiful. Thank you so very much for that introduction of each of your nonprofits. And, you know, there's a common thread. You all have that same commonality of lifting others and to help become more successful. Thank you for the good work that you do. So before you came in here today, I'll have to be honest, I had a difficult time understanding exactly what this grant means and this new grant-making approach or new or innovative. So can you help me understand exactly what the Good Relatives Collaborative Partnership means?
The Good Relatives Collaborative is really born out of the experiences that we have had as executive directors and leaders of organizations in grant writing and grant making and, you know, the whole grants world. We see so much frustration with the lack of capacity for Native organizations to be able to write grants and to manage grants. We see a lack of capacity for creating partnerships in our community. The whole value system that a lot of grant making is based on is and competitiveness and being competitive. You know, you compete for grants, you compete for limited resources. And what we see is that that hurts our communities. It creates silos. It creates, you know, wariness of each other and competition. When we first started contemplating going after this partnership, writing for this partnership and seeking this partnership, we all kind of had that same idea that we need to change the way that we do grants because our communities need to heal from that. We need our communities to work together. It's a deep-rooted value system that we have in our communities, that relatives help each other. We don't compete against each other. We help each other. And how do we reinforce that value in grant making? So that was the common core that I think really pulled us all together and made us really committed to seeking this partnership with the Bush Foundation.
We talk the talk a lot, right? And it's a little bit of walking the walk of understanding the economic injustices that all of our communities have faced over decades, and this is part of the advocacy work. So individually, each of our institutions have been advocating for different systems and structures to disperse resources to our region, and this opportunity presented itself. So when I met with all these ladies, our missions really lined up, especially as we talk about how can we get more capital from white-led institutions into the hands of Native-led institutions or into our communities, because within our region, there's a huge philanthropic gap of resources right now. You know, we don't have a lot of large funders within North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota. So having Bush Foundation within our footprint is really an opportunity, but they presented us an opportunity to take out the scarcity mindset that we're all used to and look at it from a viewpoint of abundance and just say, this is an opportunity for us to go after a partnership to build and really put money into the hands and move resources into the hands of our communities while training them and building the capacity so we can lift up the people and the opportunities and, you know, have each of these brilliant ideas come from our communities about how to, like, start a nonprofit, right, or address one of the concerns that they might see within their community. So we're really excited about what's going to come after this. We just have to get to that point yet, right?
Yeah, and a lot of work went into this. What prompted you to approach this?
I guess the prompt was there was a lack of applicants for this. The Bush Foundation put out an RFP for a partner. You know, we didn't apply because, you know, we hadn't individually, we're all maybe a little too small to take it on ourselves. But when they came out with another RFP, they said that they would be willing to take collaboratives, so groups of organizations. And if they didn't find anybody locally, they might do out-of-state or non-Native partners. And so we felt like an obligation. We needed to have it Native-led because we're serving Native organizations and Native communities. So we got together actually rather quickly. And like I said, it was really cool because we were all kind of the same mindset because we have the same experiences. And so we put the application together rather quickly. And thankfully, the Bush Foundation saw the value of what we're trying to do. They as well are moving towards a different model of how they want to do philanthropy. And so it just so happened that, you know, those things aligned and we were chosen as a partner. So that was pretty exciting.
So on the website, it says this collaboration is working with applicants' needs beyond providing grants. So what does that mean?
We want to build capacity in our communities. And what happens a lot of times is that people get the money and then it's like see you later, have a nice life. When it's time for you to do your grant report, we're waiting to hear from you. But sometimes what happens, especially if you're kind of a newer startup, you run into some little snags. Maybe some of your vision, you may have to scale it back a little bit because it's not happening as quickly as you thought. Or maybe there's some things with your bookkeeping that you need help with and managing your funds. And so we want to bring people together throughout the year around different topics where we can help each other grow and learn, but also to start establish best practices that come through a native lens that is native defined, not defined from outside of us, but it's defined within our communities.
For example, we have a lot of grassroots organizations, the movers and shakers in our little communities, the doers in our communities. And a lot of times they're not the writers, right? So we have this dilemma in our tribal communities where because we don't have a lot of grant writers, a grant writer from outside of our community, we're sort of helicopter in. They'll write a really slick grant that, you know, has all these great outcomes and all this evidence-based practice and all of that. They use all the right words and all the terminology. And then they leave, and they leave the grant with the community, and the community's like, what does this even mean? How are we supposed to do these, reach these outcomes? And it's frustrating for them because it didn't really come from them. It comes, you know, from this outside grant writer. So what we want to do is change the way we do grants. For example, many of our tribes are Lakota and Dakota-based tribes, which are oral tradition people. We want to open up the application process to even doing like oral applications. So if someone can come in and really speak, you know, passionately and intelligently about what they want to do, how they want to do it, what they want to change in their community, how this is going to heal their community, who their partners are, how they're going to work together to achieve these goals, that's really what we're aiming towards. Is just being able to get, as Lakota said, get this these funds into the hands of the communities, the doers and the movers and the shakers in our community, because we know they aren't always the grant writers.
So showing that it's not unattainable, you just need a little help to get where you're going. Is that
exactly? You know, I also think it goes back to even just defining it for our community. So if you think of like our economies and what we're exposed to, like our anchor institutions are federal entities generally, right? So they're, you know, Bureau of Indian Affairs, they're Indian Health Service, they're the school system, so your tribal government. And we haven't exposed enough of our population to the other ways of doing business. And so Forband supports entrepreneurs, and we've been working at that for 20 years of just talking about what does that mean if you want to start a business? How do you set up an LLC? How do you set up a sole proprietorship? And there's tons of curriculum out there for that, but really there's not a space for that for NGOs or nonprofits, right? And that's what we're trying to do is just say, what does that dream you have, and does it align with being an entrepreneur, or does it align with being a nonprofit and giving back to your community? And there's a lot of those dreams. There's just not a support system to take them from that dreaming ideation phase to startup, right? And that's what we're proposing to do with these funds.
The other thing that I had noticed that is in the description of Good Relatives Collaboratives is sharing a vision centered on community support and healing. So explain what that can look like here in this.
So the focus on healing really comes from this idea that as families, as Teoshpayes, we work together, we support one another, and we help each other. And unfortunately, in the world of capitalism and philanthropy, a lot of times it's competitiveness. And so we want to move away from that model to, okay, if I'm submitting a grant to do a project and I need food catered in, I'm going to look around in my community and see if there's a Native-owned business that I can support. Because in addition to just providing capital in the forms of grants, we also want to support the development and diversification of tribal economies. So that means, you know, as Lakota was saying, increasing the number of nonprofits. The cooperatives, Pamela here has a Native-based cooperative training model that we would like to incorporate too. So we're providing a full array and menu of organizational options for people in communities who are thinking about, you know, what do I want to do? How do I want to change this community? So there isn't just one way to change community, there's a lot of different ways. But a lot of times on our reservations and in our urban tribal populations, we're not exposed to those. Or if we are, they're based on this competitive model. So we want to move away from that and say, how do we support each other as relatives, and how do we change the grant-making process so that you're thinking about healing and you're thinking about working together and you're thinking about supporting each other as relatives.
So indigenizing the grant-making process,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
Indigenizing
it. Okay, said it in like a couple words that we just talked about for 20 minutes, but yeah.
Something else, too, is that we want to kind of turn philanthropy on its head a little bit. Because the model calls for people, it's kind of almost like we call it poverty Olympics. So you go into writing a grant and all you're looking at is the deficits in your community. And we want to focus on also what are those assets, because we have unbelievable assets in our communities and they're constantly overlooked. And it's really about building from that place of assets and changing that narrative so that we're not always focusing on everything that's wrong, but what are some things that are right that are in the community, and how can we pull those together with the right people to make the changes that the community wants?
What we're talking about is changing the application process too, to be how is your project or how is your thought or your idea going to heal the community? How is your project or your thought or your idea going to partner, you know, with other organizations or businesses or individuals? How are you going to reach out into your community? So I think by just changing the questions that we ask, it will actually make it easier for Native and urban tribal grantees, because we're going to focus it on how do you want to change the world, right? How do you want to change your community? How do you want to heal your community, rather than who are you and what do you have the qualifications to do? And part of, like you say, indigenizing the process is making it so that people are focusing on the work that needs to be done and not who's doing it.
I also just want to say, like, there's power in us leading this as Native women, because it's how you perceive is how you proceed. So the perceptions that we carry into this work cannot be undervalued. You know, we live and breathe the communities. We understand what's going on there. And so we're perceiving our communities with strength, right? Mm-hmm. We see that. And so I think that that's going to help tease out those stories. And we've also built in some systems of having an advocate or a coach aligned with the applicant. We're still working out the details, but we really believe in what you're saying of, like, sometimes it's hard to talk about ourselves, but if you set a coach up next to you, that coach can definitely tease out, well, this is why Pamela is so amazing, this is why Barb's so amazing, and hopefully they can team up and do it together to present their idea to the review committee or the panel. And so we're thinking of ways to that and to make sure that we're accommodating those individuals. But I really do think the strength of it is the perceptions that we have as Native people using this money to push it into the communities, because we perceive the strengths in our communities, mm-hmm. and rightly so.
And that's one of the things about the uniqueness of the program, too, or the project, is that we do have these coaches. You're not going to be out there all by yourself. You're not going to be lone wolfing it. We're going to be assisting you and providing technical assistance in moving the grant forward, helping you do your grant writing, and moving it forward to present to the committee, you know, to get the grant. So building capacity, it's all about building capacity. And when you look at building capacity in communities, you're building your economic development.
So you're the team behind the person applying for the grant.
Right. We're the aunties. We're the aunties. Because we also really don't want to say, oh, we're not going to fund you. We're going to say, here's how you can strengthen mm-hmm. your proposal and your idea. Go back and try again. Yeah. Because a lot of times in philanthropy, it's like, okay, if you don't get it, you walk away with your head down and kicking rocks. And we're like, no. We want to provide this coaching experience and this learning from current grantees' experience, so that you're always building capacity and you're always strengthening your ideas and your proposals. That's really what grant writing is all about, and we want to support that. So it isn't, it's never like, oh no, this is a terrible proposal, but here's how you can strengthen it. So things like that into the process, I think, is really a cornerstone of what we're trying to do as well.
So it's going to help us find individuals that are biased towards action. So we hear a lot of this in the community of just saying, I wish somebody would do something about that, you know. And right now what we're saying with this money is we're going to find those somebodies and say to them, you're that somebody. What are you going to do about it? Now here's the tools and the resources you can get to that next stage, right? And so we're going to go find the somebodies out there for sure.
I love that. So this is a six-year partnership.
So the 6 years time span was established by the Bush Foundation, but we really have high hopes that the way we do things will be innovative enough and will demonstrate success enough that we can have an impact on other organizations that do philanthropy. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the listenership that you have here that may be listening to this program, you know, there may be people that sit on philanthropic boards or commissions or, you know, who may even work in those types of organizations. We really want to be able to demonstrate that there are different ways of doing things that can pull out the assets of communities, as we were talking about, the positive assets and the strengths of communities. And we really just need to change the way we do things. And maybe some of those ideas hopefully will grow in the philanthropic community, and we might have an impact that's larger than these 6 years.
So over the six-year partnership, what does the timeline of this look like?
Well, right now we are currently in the planning process, and we're hoping that by the fall of 2022 that we will have the application materials ready to be sent out, with our intent of having our first grant to be awarded at the beginning quarter of 2023. Since it's a learning process for us, we're hoping that we would be able to deploy funds probably maybe semi-annually. And this first year or two is going to be a learning process for us, so that we may have to tweak it later and say, you know what, we could handle the amount of grant requests that we're getting, and that we may go quarterly. We may go every 3 months or whatever. But right now, we're going to focus on just providing applications or awards semi-annually, every 6 months.
What kind of projects do you foresee coming through?
In Minnesota, there's a lot of language revitalization that's taking place in the communities, and there's some people on the ground, you know, in those tribal communities that are doing amazing cultural work and that really get overlooked. But they're bringing community together, and they're getting people to work together. They're learning new things. They're revitalizing cultural knowledge and life ways, but they're also revitalizing language. That's one way. There's education. There is, you know, working with families, social justice. There's, you know, there's all these different issues in our communities. There's the arts, you know, kind of thriving and building a strong arts ecosystem, you know. So there's a lot of different things that can be funded, you know, in our communities. That's just to name a few.
And when you look at economic development, especially in a community, you are looking at infrastructure, you're looking at housing, social services. So when an individual is coming and going to apply for a grant, we want to make sure that, like Cheryl mentioned earlier, is that we want to make sure that they partner with individual or organizations within the community that will expand that, build on that capacity that they have for building economic development within the community. So there's a wide range.
You know, we've seen COVID kind of spur a lot of the food regeneration, sort of sustainable, you know, ag issues. And we've had a lot of community members want to address that issue so that we don't ever come into that crisis again of having a grocery truck show up to your community and it be out of meat or it be out of something else, right, that have impacted a lot of us in rural areas. So, and then we've also had a lot of individuals want to work on healing with youth and horsemanship and, you know, being important to the culture and finding ways to work on that during the summer months. But there's a lot of ideas that are bubbling. They just need the support to take it to the next level.
So part of this project is that we also have three partners, one in the state of North Dakota, which is the Strengthen ND, one in Minnesota, which is the Headwaters Foundation, and one in South Dakota, which is the South Dakota Community Foundation. We are the only collaborative that is going to be working across the three states as a collaborative. And our primary focus will be the Native communities and tribal populations. So we really want to make this process helpful for them. So that includes plans to go out and to introduce the grant and to let people know how we're doing things differently so that they can prepare to put a proposal in.
Perfect. Now I understand. Now I can wrap my head around this. Thank you so much for indigenizing my show today. I love it. It's the aunties.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
That was Alicia Heglin-Thorpe with Dr. Barb Schmidt of the Black Hills Community Loan Fund, Lakota Vogel of the Four Bands Community Fund, Pamela Standig of the Minnesota Indigenous Business Alliance, and Dr. Cheryl Carey of the Sacred Pipe Resource Center. Still to come on Main Street, confused about the sheer number of candidates in some races? A website can help. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. One of the largest employers in northeastern North Dakota is closing later this year. Winnipeg-headquartered New Flyer Industries is shutting down its charter and transit bus manufacturing plant in Pembina. Mayor Mike Fitzgerald says the city was notified of the closing in a letter.
It's going to be a blow to the region. You know, Cavalier, Wahala, Nitche, Lancaster, Hallock, Minnesota. A lot of 232 people, I believe, are employed there. It's going to be a blow to the region. Like, the gas station's going to take a hit. The local grocery store is going to take a hit. It's going to be devastating.
Fitzgerald says New Flyer, which has more than 200 employees in Pembina, says the letter cited difficulty in finding quality employees, the plant's location, and the company's plan to begin the conversion to electric buses. New Flyer also has a plant in Crookston, Minnesota. The Pembina plant opened in 1963. The Minnesota House and Senate negotiators have reached a compromise on an omnibus liquor bill. The agreement includes an adjustment to the state's growler gap, authorizing larger brewers to sell more beer per customer per day. Stillwater Republican Senator Karen Housley.
There's a lot of other little liquor provisions in the conference committee report that I think Minnesotans will be happy with the cocktail rooms at the distilleries, and our resorts now aren't limited to just selling 3-2 beer.
Minnesota lawmakers face a Sunday adjournment deadline. They're still working on issues such as education and bonding. And the nationwide United States Department of Agriculture waivers that provided free meals to children during the COVID-19 pandemic will expire at the end of this school year. The North Dakota Schools School Foods and Nutrition Office has been working with schools to transition their program operations back to normal for the 2022-2023 school year. Linda Schloer, North Dakota's Director of Child Nutrition and Food Distribution Program, says there might be some struggle returning school cafeterias to their pre-COVID operations.
It's going to be quite a transition, actually, because families have not been used to filling out those application forms. And a lot of families probably have never had to go through that process in order to get free meals for their children. We anticipate that there will be a lot of confusion with families trying to understand the change and what that entails. And then also having to pay for meals, we feel that there could be quite a bit of a problem with families not paying for their meals and then school districts having unpaid meal charges piling up.
Schloers encourage parents to contact their school about the process of signing up and paying for meals in the coming school year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Touchmark at Harwood Groves, Fargo, and on West Century in Bismarck. Touchmark offers maintenance-free living so residents have more time to enjoy what they love. Fresh prepared meals, health and fitness club, and a full calendar of events with friends nearby. Learn more at touchmark.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The North Dakota primary election is right around the corner on Tuesday, June 14th, and it's proving to be a crowded field in a lot of local elections. That's why the League of Women Voters is providing vote411.org as a one-stop shop for voting and election information. They use vote411 to make knowing who's running and what they stand for easier to read about for voters. Alicia Heglin-Thorpe visits with Whitney Oxendahl, the Vote 411 coordinator.
Welcome, Whitney.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So first of all, what is the League of Women Voters?
A nonpartisan political organization that works to connect people with government at all levels, local, county, state, and also empower voters with voting and election information. We have the State League, which is the League of Women Voters of North Dakota, and then we have two chapters. So we have a Bismarck-Mandan League chapter and one in the Red River Valley. So that's Fargo-Moorhead. And it goes across state lines. And then if anyone else wants to be a member, they're at large, and we will just connect them with the closest chapter near them.
Okay, and you're always looking for new members.
We are. If you want to get involved in voting and election information, our candidate forums, join us. We would love to have you.
So we're talking about 411. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Vote411.org is a national platform that the League of Women Voters of the United States bought up, and they wanted to fulfill their mission of empowering voters with election information. So they offered it to the state and local leagues to use to do a voter guide for voters in that area. It has information on absentee ballots, on where you can drop off your ballot, your polling location. But then what's special about Vote 411 is you can put on a personalized ballot. So we could send out information to candidates to fill out on the website, and they could input on their own. Click a link, fill it out, upload their photo, and then when voters enter their address, they can see all the races that will be on their ballot and also compare the candidates, hearing from candidates in their own words, which I think is really special about the site.
Right. So if you're a candidate and listening to this, or if you know one, tell them to get to this website and fill out their information.
Yes. So we either emailed or sent out a letter to all the candidates in the state that filed with the Secretary of State's office. But some candidates, either they just haven't had a chance to do it yet, or they're waiting to closer to the election. And the more we have the candidate information filled out, the more useful it is to voters. So if you see a candidate on there that hasn't filled it out, please reach out to them and say, hey, can you fill out the Vote 411 voter guide from the league? And that will just help other voters, too, to know that information.
And so this isn't just including North Dakota, though, right?
That's correct. So our league is providing the North Dakota information. The Minnesota league is covering the local candidates for the Minnesota primary coming up in August. If you're in another state and listening in, you can also enter your address and see if it's close to a primary. Like ours went live on May 5th. So before that, you wouldn't have seen the candidate information in there. But now it is live and you can go on at any time, day or night, and enter your address and see those candidates and what they had to say.
How did the idea of this voter guide platform come about?
The mission of the league is really to empower people with information about government and about voting. So one of the big pieces of the mission is that empowerment of voters. And this just really helps achieve that mission because especially those local candidates, they can be so hard to find information on. You really have to track them down, especially when you have a lot of people in those races. We really wanted to provide that information and make it so easy and accessible so people can choose who they would like to vote for.
It's like a one-stop shop for all your election needs.
That is the perfect way to explain what the site is. You can go on and find information about how you can vote in your area and then also hear from candidates. So there's just a plethora of things you can find out on the site.
Vote 411 has sponsors. What is the significance of having sponsorships, organizations, and the voter guide?
So when we put the site together, we really wanted to reach voters across the whole state. And to do that, we need more resources. So we decided to open it up for sponsorships. So organizations can go to our site and look at our sponsorship page for Vote 411 and sponsor the site. And that funding will go to doing more marketing for the site, just to get it in front of voters so that it can be easily accessible to them. We are just really excited to provide it, especially for those local races. I don't think that anyone has ever done a voter guide covering every candidate in the state before. And so we just feel really lucky that we can provide this information to all North Dakota voters.
This could really change the way people find out about elections.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for the future. So this is our first time doing it. So we have found ways that we can make it more smooth for the future. The first time you do it, there's always like you're just figuring things out, like how do I collect the data? How do I get it out to candidates? And so we found there are definitely ways that we can make the process go more smoothly in the future. And candidates now know that this is offered. We've come across many candidates that just they have not heard of the League of Women Voters of North Dakota. So we have to explain who we are and then say, hey, this is a great tool for you to communicate directly to voters in your area. So it's been a great way for us to get to know candidates and for candidates to get to know who we are as well.
There's a lot of information here to learn about the candidates, but what about ballot initiatives and things like that?
So there is a way to enter ballot initiatives on the site. We will see more of those statewide ones. We'll see if anyone gets on the ballot, and those will come on for the general election. And we are going to be researching if there are local city or county measures that people are voting on, and we will be adding those to the site as we come across them.
How many people does it take to run this website? I mean, you're constantly updating things. So how does that work?
The National League, thankfully, provides the website, the core part of the website. And so we can send them, we looked through the links and sent them updates to the North Dakota information. And the candidate piece is the one that takes a bit of time. So I have been the main contact for that. And then I have a team of about 5 to 7 volunteers to help me with candidate outreach and updating things on the site. So it has been a lot of time and energy input, but we are so excited to have this ready for voters.
Oh, yeah. And thank goodness for volunteers, right?
I know. And my team has been so great in helping me put together the information and reach out to candidates. They've been amazing.
This election season seems to be really interesting. There are some local races out there that we all have our eyes on. For example, like the school board races. There's a couple of different cities that are pretty contested, and then maybe some mayoral races. What are you hearing?
It's been fun to get a bird's eye view of all of the local races in the state. I'm covering over 2,000 candidates and over 1,000 different races, statewide, county, and local in the city elections. Some of the bigger ones are Grand Forks School Board race. They have 23 candidates for 5 open
wow.
seats on the school board.
Wow.
That's the biggest one in the state. But then you also have a lot of contested races in Minot, and Bismarck Mandan has contested races, like your mayoral race is fun to watch. Grand Forks, Wahpeton, and even where I'm located in Fargo, we have 15 people running for school board, and there are 5 seats open. And then you have some smaller cities. Like there's a really great city council race in Crosby, North Dakota, that there are a lot of candidates for. I'm having a fun time watching these races. Another one that's really fun is the sheriff's race in Nelson County, which is just to the west of Grand Forks County. And there are 5 people running for sheriff. With the county races, you vote for 1 and then the top 2 go on to November. And so you'll see 5 people and then only 2 will go on in that race. So there are some really fun races that I'm watching.
Whitney, can you tell me what are the barriers that you're seeing with women running for office?
We find that there can be some barriers for women in particular running for office. Sometimes women need extra encouragement to say, hey, you would be a great candidate. You should really run for office, especially those local races. There needs to be training. There needs to be outreach just to let women know that they would be a great candidate. A campaign is very in-depth. You have to door knock. You have to put yourself out on social media. And so a great way is to encourage women in your life to get out there and run for office. Another barrier is some women are afraid of any kind of pushback or negativity toward them when they're out campaigning. So there have been great trainings recently from the North Dakota Women's Network. They have been doing a lot of action on trying to make women feel comfortable and putting themselves out there to run for office.
So what are some of the voting barriers that we're seeing in these elections?
In North Dakota, we have pretty good voter turnout, but one area we see is for women, a lot of women feel like they don't know about what's happening in statewide or local politics. We have found some candidates saying that when they go door knocking, that a lot of women do not feel like they know about the issues. They come across many. And so I feel like Vote 411 can kind of bridge that gap and make you feel more comfortable, especially in those local races, knowing who is running for office. We're really excited about that. And there have been also voter ID issues across the state. Different people in tribal nations, they might have trouble accessing a voter ID. And so that's something that we are planning to just be an ally for in the future, to make sure everyone has access to voting in the state, and just to make just so that we can break down some of those barriers and make it easier for people to vote.
You have the perfect resource for people to, again, that's vote411.org. Or the other way that people can find out about you is how?
You can find this information on candidates on vote411.org. You can enter your address and then see that list of the races and then compare the candidates within those races. And if you want to find out more about the League of Women Voters of North Dakota, you can check us out at our website, lwvnd.org. And you can find information out about Vote 411 and about how to become a member of one of our chapters. And then another great way to follow along with Vote 411 is by following us on our Facebook for the League of Women Voters of North Dakota. We are posting, I have a post going out where someone really, really loved checking out the site. It's exactly what they were looking for. They had reached out to me. And so I'll be posting their quote tonight about just like, thank you for providing this resource to me.
Real quick, too, I also noticed you have candidate forums on there, too, that you've posted on your Facebook page as well, correct?
That is correct. So each of our chapters did candidate forums for the local contested races. So the Red River Valley chapter, we had candidate forums for the Fargo School Board, the mayor, the city commission, and the West Fargo School Board as well. And then Bismarck Mandan, they recorded theirs and posted them in partnership with Dakota Media Access out in Bismarck. And that's a great way to really see the candidates speaking. It can really affect how you want to vote when you actually see them. And I linked those at the top. If you look, go on Vote 411 and in your Bismarck Mandan or Fargo, West Fargo, you will see a link to it at the top of that race.
Thank you so much, Whitney, for spending the time with us today to educate the public about what 411 is and how resourceful it is for finding out about our local races. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I love sharing.
That was Whitney Oxendahl of the Red River chapter of the League of Women Voters. She is the coordinator for the Vote 411 effort. She was talking with Alicia Hegland-Thorpe. Madeline is next.
Got a picnic, parade, art fair, street fair, play concert, class, or fundraiser you want people to know about? We'll get the word out with Prairie Public's Community Calendar. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community and submit your event today. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, unearthing local history in your community, and building an immersive museum experience at the Yumcom Center. Details at hcscconline.org.
When you hear the fanfare, you know it's time for another movie review with Matt O'Lean. Matt, I watched the trailer again, as usual, for the film The Duke. Looks pretty charming.
It's the kind of movie, Ashley, that the Brits have pulled off for decades. This goes back to a tradition with something called the Ealing Studios back in the 40s and 50s. That was a movie studio in Britain that made these kind of light comedies that usually centered around an eccentric group of people in a small village or something like that. Alec Guinness was in a lot of them.
That sounds very
and
British.
That's kind of been a tradition through the years of British comedies like this. And that's what this reminded me of. It's based on a true story. Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren play the married couple in the film. And if you've seen the trailer, Jim Broadbent's character is based on a real person who stole the Francisco Goya painting of the Duke of Wellington. And why he steals it is quite interesting. It's not what you think. This is a kind-hearted man who drives taxi. He's always trying to help people. He stands up for coworkers who might be racially discriminated against. He's just doing the right thing all the time. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to pay the television tax that was required in Great Britain back then if you had the BBC, because he's rigged his television to not have the BBC. So he's always against the establishment, fighting against that, much to the consternation of his wife, played by Helen Mirren in a very stern performance. They have a couple kind of ne'er-do-well sons who kind of live with them and don't live with them sometimes. But the film is based on his kind of outwardly gentle manner, giving back to society, trying to show society of why this painting was stolen and what he wants for it in return. So it's all done in a charming way. Some things don't quite come off. They're playing younger than they are. So their characters they play are probably in their early 60s. Helen Mirren, Jim Broadbent, both in their 70s now. So the age felt a little off to me, especially with young sons kind of in the house in their 20s and early 30s. But you just forgive that because these are two British stalwart actors playing. It's really Jim Broadbent's film. Helen Mirren's great, but this is really Jim Broadbent's movie. Nobody quite can play that kind of affable English bloke from the middle to lower classes, quite like Jim Broadbent can. Mm. He's the go-to actor for performances like that.
I'm not familiar with him.
He's an Oscar winner for the film Iris, which he co-starred with Judi Dench. He is just in countless movies. He's a working British actor who's become quite famous across the pond here as well. And I think this is the kind of film, even though it's not going to win awards, it's not going to break any new ground, it's the kind of film, if you're maybe middle to older movie-going audiences, this would be the perfect movie to go see at this point. The Duke, the name of the movie is based on, of course, the Duke of Wellington painting. It's a short film. It's not overly long. It doesn't outstay its welcome, as we say in the business. So overall, I liked it. It's not a great film. But it certainly passes the time, and it gives Jim Broadbent a real scene-stealing, scenery-chewing part to really sink his teeth into.
Did they go into, and don't give any spoilers, but why that painting? Was there something significant about that painting?
Yeah, I won't say too much, but it's based on a scene that happens he and his son are watching.
Because you think you know you're going to steal, maybe not the Mona Lisa anymore because it's way guarded, but you'd think something that is huge, huge in value. But
yeah, so there's some backstory about the painting and why it ends up back at this major museum in London, and so that is really the impetus for him to steal the painting. Now, I will say there is a major plot twist in this movie that you might not see coming that I thought was fairly cleverly handled. It's, again, based on a true story, so you can look it all up if you want to before you go to the movie, but I would not do that if I were people. So this recently had a run at the Fargo Theater. I believe that's ending, but it's out there. It's out there in theaters, so look for it where you live.
All right. For some Oscar trivia, Helen Mirren won an Oscar for playing Queen Elizabeth II in The Queen. And I want a list of actresses who have won an Oscar for playing real-life people. And we don't have to maybe go through all this, so, but, you know, give me five.
Actresses who played real-life
who have won an Oscar for winning for playing a real person. So we'll give you Helen Mirren here.
Okay. Oh, boy. I have to go through my brain here as we're doing this. And now
I'm kind of doing film years, if that's...
That'd be fine. Yeah, okay. You can do that.
How about 2009? This is the film year, not the Oscar year. So 2010, I guess.
2009. Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side. Okay. Yes.
2018.
Olivia Colman for The Favorite.
Okay. 2002.
Nicole Kidman as Virginia Woolf in The Hours.
2003.
Charlize Theron as the murderer, what was her name, in Monster.
In Monster, yep.
Yes.
2007.
2007. Marion Cotillard as Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose.
2005.
Reese Witherspoon as June Carter Cash in Walk
the
Line.
List. All right, 2011.
Let's keep going. 2011. Oh, boy. Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady.
And the most recent, and I didn't write down the year, but who would maybe be the most recent? Another singer, actress. She was in The Wizard of Oz.
Renee Zellweger and Judy.
There you go.
Yes. Okay.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Tom Brusseau. On the next Great American Folk Show, he's worked with Jason Mraz, John Doe, and, well, yours truly. It's my pal, singer and songwriter Gregory Page. Plus, cowboy poet Bill Lohman previews this year's Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering. Viral food critic Marilyn Hagerty joins me at Darcy's Cafe in Grand Forks for a Dakota Diners visit. And we'll have live music from Arthur Matos. Searching for home. Just like you. on the Great American Folk Show this Saturday at 5 p.m. Central Time on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 20th. No matter how mighty your locomotive is, it will need a bridge to cross a river. As a result, there are hundreds of railroad bridges scattered across the state of North Dakota. One very significant bridge is the High Line Bridge near Valley City. The Northern Pacific Railroad had actually been going through the town of Valley City before building the bridge. It crossed the Cheyenne River on a low bridge, but then had an arduous climb up the steep river valley. To resolve this problem, they decided to build a tall bridge about a mile upstream. Work began on June 30th, 1906, and what a project it was. It took 14 million pounds of steel and 10,000 cubic feet of concrete to support the columns. Adding stability was 80,000 linear feet of wood. It took 160 men to do the work. There's some disagreement about the final measurements of the bridge. Some sources say it's 3,860 feet long and 162 feet above the river. Others say it's 3,886 feet long and 155 feet high. Either way, at the time it was finished, it was the longest bridge of that height in the entire world. The bridge was officially ready for service on May 8, 1908, and the first train crossed it 4 days later on May 12th. On this date in 1908, the High Line Bridge was officially opened for regular service, and it remains in use to this very day. The bridge was closely guarded during both World Wars due to its importance for transporting supplies. Company H from the North Dakota National Guard in Jamestown took on that duty for World War I. After Pearl Harbor, the bridge was initially guarded by volunteers from the American Legion, VFW, and railroad personnel. But Company F of the North Dakota National Guard soon took over. The High Line Bridge remains one of the longest and highest bridges in the United States. It is still recognized as an amazing feat of engineering, and in 2005 it was dedicated as a National Historic Civil Engineering Landmark by the American Society of Civil Engineers. This Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Marie Offutt.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
My question is, why does a Q always end with a U?
Have you heard of this book, Who Moved My Cheese?
I wanted to ask about the phrase, do it up brown. I don't hear it at all from my peer group, but I do hear it from older people.
All right, what is that? Where is it from?
Join us this week on Away With Words.
This is a really convincing explanation.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, it's time for another Philosophical Currents with Jack Russell Weinstein. We talk about the idea of changing a person's mind and beliefs. Is it even possible? And should you try? That's Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.